Chapter 9. Traps. "And she complained again that the other wise ones are timid," Fail finished in her best meek voice, shifting the tall basket she held balanced on one shoulder, shifting from foot to foot in the muddy snow. The basket was not heavy, though filled with dirty laundry, and the wool of her white robe was thick and warm, with two under-robes beneath, but her soft leather boots, themselves bleached white, gave little protection from the cold slush. "I was told to report what the wise one, Savannah, said exactly," she added quickly. Somerin was one of the other wise ones, and her mouth had turned down at the word timid. With her eyes lowered, that was all Fail could see of Somerin's face. Gaishine were required to maintain a humble manner, especially the Gaishine who were not Aiel, and though she looked up through her eyelashes to read Somerin's expression, the other woman was taller than most men, even Aiel men, a yellow-haired giant who towered over her. Most of what she could see was Somerin's overlarge bosom, plump, sun-dark cleavage exposed by a blouse unlaced halfway down her chest, and covered mainly by a massive collection of long necklaces, firedrops and emeralds, rubies and opals, three-tiered strands of fat pearls, and intricately patterned chains of gold. Most of the wise ones seemed to dislike Savannah, who spoke for the chief, until a new Shido clan chief could be chosen, an event unlikely to occur any time soon, and they tried to undercut her authority whenever they were not squabbling among themselves or forming cliques. But many shared Savannah's love of wetlander jewelry, and some had even begun wearing finger rings like Savannah. On her right hand, Somerin wore a large white opal that flashed caverns of red whenever she adjusted her shawl, and a long blue sapphire surrounded by rubies on the left. She had not adopted silk clothing, however. Her blouse was plain white algoda from the waist, and her skirt and shawl thick wool, as dark as the folded scarf that held her waist-long yellow hair back from her face. The cold did not appear to discomfort her in the least. The two of them stood just beyond what Fail thought of as the border between the Shido camp and the Gaishine camp, the prisoners' camp. Not that there really were two camps. A few Gaishine slept among the Shido, but the rest were kept to the center of the camp, unless doing their assigned work. Cattle, fenced off from the lure of freedom by a wall of Shido. Most of the men and women who passed them wore white Gaishine robes, though few as finely woven as what she wore. With so many to clothe, the Shido scooped up any sort of white cloth they could find. Some were garbed in layers of coarse linen or toweling, or robes of rough tent cloth, and many of the robes were stained with mud or soot. Only now and then did one of the Gaishine show the height and pale eyes of an Aiel. The vast majority were ruddy-faced Amadisians, olive-skinned Altarans, and pale Kyrianen, along with occasional travelers or merchants from Ilion or Tarabon or elsewhere, who had found themselves in the worst place at the worst time. The Kyrianen were the longest-held and most resigned to their situation, aside from the handful of Aiel in white, but they all kept their eyes down and moved about their tasks as fast as the trampled mush of snow and mud would allow. Gaishine were expected to display humility, obedience, and an eagerness to embrace both. Any less resulted in painful reminders. Fail would very much have liked to hurry on herself. Cold feet were only a small part of it, and eagerness to do Savannah's laundry less. Too many eyes could see her standing there in the open with Somerin, and even with her deep cowl hiding her face, the broad mesh belt of shiny gold links around her waist, and a close-fitting collar to match, marked her as one of Savannah's servants. No one called them that. In Aiel eyes, being a servant was demeaning, but that was what they were. The wetlanders, at least, just unpaid and with fewer rights and less freedom than any servant Fail had ever heard tell of. Sooner or later, Savannah herself was going to learn that wise ones were stopping her Gaishine to question them. Savannah had well over 100 servants and kept adding to them, and Fail was certain that every last one was repeating every word they heard Savannah say to the wise ones. It was a brutally efficient trap. Savannah was a harsh mistress, in a rather casual way, never snapping, seldom openly angry, but the slightest infraction, the smallest slip in demeanor or behavior, was punished immediately with the switch or the strap, and every night the 5 Guy Shine who had pleased her least that day were chosen out for further punishment, sometimes a night bound and gagged on top of a beating, just to encourage the rest. Fail did not want to think of what the woman would order for a spy. On the other hand, the wise ones had made it clear that anyone who did not talk freely of what they heard, anyone who tried to hold back or bargain, faced an uncertain future, possibly ending in a shallow grave. Harming a guy shine beyond the permitted limits of discipline was a violation of Ji'ito, the web of honor and obligation that governed the lives of Aiel. But Wetlander Guy Shine seemed to stand outside a number of the rules. Sooner or later, one side or the other of that trap would snap shut. All that had held the jaws apart this long was that the Shido seemed to see their Wetlander Guy Shine as no different from cart horses or pack animals, though in truth the animals received far better treatment. Now and then a Guy Shine tried to run away, but aside from that, one simply gave them food and shelter, put them to work, and punished them if they faltered. The wise ones no more expected them to disobey. Savannah no more expected them to spy on her than they expected a cart horse to sing. Sooner or later, though, and that was not the only trap Fail was caught in. "Wise one, I have nothing more to tell," she murmured when Somerin said nothing. Unless you were addled in the head, you did not just walk away from a wise one, not until she dismissed you. The wise one Savannah talks freely in front of us, but she says little. The tall woman remained silent, and after a long moment, Fail dared to raise her eyes a little more. Somerin was staring over Fail's head, her mouth hanging open in stunned amazement. Frowning, Fail shifted the basket on her shoulder and looked behind her, but there was nothing to account for Somerin's expression, just the sprawl of the camp, dark, low Aiel tents mingled with peaked tents and walled tents and every sort of tent, most in shades of dirty white or pale brown, others green or blue or red or even striped. The Shido took everything valuable when they struck, everything that might prove useful, and they left behind nothing that resembled a tent. As it was, they hardly had enough shelter to go around. There were 10 septs gathered here, more than 70,000 Shido, and nearly as many Guy Shine by her estimate, and everywhere she saw only the usual bustle, dark-clad Aiel going about their lives among scurrying white-clad captives. A smith was working the bellows on his forge in front of an open tent with his tools laid out on a tanned bullhide. Children were herding flocks of bleating goats with switches. A trader was displaying her goods in an open pavilion of yellow canvas, everything from golden candlesticks and silver bowls to pots and kettles, all looted. A lean man with a horse on a lead stood talking with a gray-haired wise one named Massalin, no doubt seeking a cure for some ailment the animal had, from the way he kept pointing at the horse's belly. Nothing to make Somerin gape. Just as Fail was about to turn back around, she noticed a dark-haired Aiel woman facing the other way. Not just dark hair, but hair black as a raven's wing, a great rarity among Aiel. Even from behind, Fail thought she recognized Alaris, another of the wise ones. There were over 400 wise ones in the camp, but she had learned quickly to know all of them on sight. Mistaking a wise one for a weaver or a potter was a quick way to earn a switching. It might have meant nothing that Alaris was standing stock still and looking in the same direction as Somerin, or that she had let her shawl slide to the ground, except that just beyond her, Fail recognized still another wise one, also looking off to the north and west, and slapping at people who walked in front of her. That had to be Jassine, a woman who would have been called short, even if she were not Aiel, with a great mass of hair, red enough to make fire look pale, and a temper to match. Massalin was talking to the man with the horse and gesturing to the animal. She could not channel, but three wise ones who could were all staring in the same direction. Only one thing could account for it. They saw someone channeling up there on the forested ridgeline beyond the camp. A wise one channeling surely would not make any of them stare. Could it be an Aes Sedai? Or more than one? Better not to get her hopes up. It was too soon. A clout on her head staggered her, and she nearly dropped the basket. "Why are you standing like a lump?" Samarin snarled. "Go on with your work. Go, before I—" Fayil went, balancing the basket with one hand, lifting the skirts of her robe out of the muddy snow with the other, and moving as quickly as she could without slipping and falling in the muck. Samarin never hit anyone, and she never raised her voice. If she was doing both, it was best to be out of her way with no delay, humbly and obediently. Pride said to maintain a cool defiance, a quiet refusal to yield. Yet sense said that was the way to find herself guarded twice as closely as she was. The Shido might take the wetlander Guy Shine for domesticated animals, but they were not completely blind. They must think that she had accepted her captivity as inescapable, if she were to be able to escape. And that was very much on her mind. The sooner the better. Certainly before Perrin caught up. She had never doubted that Perrin was following her, that he would find her somehow. The man would walk through a wall if he took it into his head. But she had to escape before that. She was a soldier's daughter. She knew the Shido's numbers. She knew the strength Perrin had to call on, and she knew she had to reach him before that clash could take place. There was just the little matter of getting free of the Shido first. What had the wise ones been looking at? The Aes Sedai, or wise ones with Perrin? Light, she hoped not yet. But other matters took precedence, the laundry not least. She carried the basket toward what remained of the city of Malden, weaving through a steady flow of Guy Shine. Those leaving the city each carried a pair of heavy buckets balanced on the ends of a pole carried across the shoulders, while the buckets of those going in swayed empty on their poles. As many people as were in the camp required a great deal of water, and this was how it came to them, bucket by bucket. It was easy to tell the Guy Shine who had been inhabitants of Malden. This far north in Altara they were fair rather than olive-complected, and some even had blue eyes, but all stumbled along in a daze. Shido climbing the city walls in the night had overwhelmed the defenses before most of the residents knew they were in danger, and they still seemed unable to believe what their lives had come to. Fayil searched for a particular face, though, someone she hoped would not be carrying water today. She had been looking ever since the Shido made camp here 4 days ago. Just outside the city gates, which stood open and shoved back against the granite walls, she found her, a white-clad woman taller than herself with a flat basket of bread on her hip and her hood pushed back just enough to show a bit of dark reddish hair. Chiad appeared to be studying the iron-strapped gates that had failed to protect Malden, but she turned away from them as soon as Fayil approached. They paused side by side, not really looking at one another while they pretended to shift their baskets. There was no reason two Guy Shine should not talk to one another, but no one should remember that they had been captured together. Bane and Chiad were not watched as closely as Guy Shine serving Savannah, but that might change if anyone remembered. Almost everyone in sight was Guy Shine, and from west of the Dragon Wall besides, yet too many had learned to curry favor by carrying tales and rumors. Most people did what they must to survive, and some always tried to feather their own nests, whatever the circumstances. "They got away the first night here," Chiad murmured. "Bane and I led them out to the trees and obscured the tracks coming back. No one seems to realize they are gone, as far as I can see. With so many Guy Shine, it seems a wonder these Shido notice any who run away." Fayil heaved a small sigh of relief. 3 days gone. The Shido did notice runaways. Few managed a full day of freedom, but the chances of success increased with every day uncaught, and it seemed certain the Shido would move on tomorrow or the next day. They had not halted as long as this since Fail was captured. She suspected they might be trying to march back to the Dragon Wall and recross into the Waste. It had not been easy talking Lassiel and Arala into leaving without her. What finally convinced them had been the argument that they could carry word to Perrin of where Fail was, along with a warning of how many Shido there were, and a claim that Fail already had her own escape well in hand, and any interference by him might endanger that and her. She was sure she had made them believe all of that. She did have her escape in hand, in a way. She had several plans, in fact, and one of them had to work. But until this minute she had been half convinced the two women would decide their oaths to her required them to stay. Water oaths were tighter than oaths of fealty in some ways, yet they left considerable room for stupidity in the name of honor. In truth, she did not know whether the pair could find Perrin, but either way they were free, and she had only two other women to worry about. Of course, the absence of three of Savannah's servants would be noticed very quickly, within hours, and the best trackers would be sent to bring them back. Fail was accustomed to the woods, but she knew better than to pit herself against Aiel trackers. It was very unpleasant for ordinary Guyshine who ran away and were recaptured. For Savannah's Guyshine, it might be better to die in the attempt. At best, they would never be allowed the opportunity for a second try. "The rest of us would have a better chance if you and Bane came with us," she said in a low voice. The flow of men and women in white carrying water by them continued, no one seeming to more than glance their way, but wariness had become ingrained in her these last 2 weeks. Light, it seemed more like 2 years. "What difference can there be between helping Lassiel and Arala reach the forest and helping the rest of us get further?" That was despair talking. She knew the difference. Bane and Chiad were her friends and had taught her about Aiel ways, about Je'ito and even a little maiden hand talk, and it did not surprise her when Chiad turned her head slightly to regard her with gray eyes that had nothing of Guyshine meekness in them. Nor did her voice, though she still spoke quietly. "I will help you as far as I can because it is not right for the Shido to hold you. You do not follow Je'ito. I do. If I cast aside my honor and my obligations just because the Shido have, then I allow them to decide how I will act. I will wear white for a year and a day, and then they will release me or I will walk away, but I will not throw away who I am." Without another word, Chiad strode off into the throngs of Guyshine. Fail half raised a hand to stop her, then let it fall. She had asked that question before, receiving a gentler answer, and in asking again she had insulted her friend. She would have to apologize. Not to keep Chiad's help, the woman would not withdraw that, but because she had her own honor, even if she did not follow Je'ito. You did not insult friends and simply forget it or expect them to. Apologies must wait, though. They dared not be seen talking too long. Malden had been a prosperous city, a producer of good wool and great quantities of fair quality wine, but an empty ruin inside the walls now. As many of the slate-roofed houses were timber as were stone, and fire had gotten loose during the looting. The southern end of the city was half piles of blackened timbers decorated with icicles, half scorched roofless walls. The streets everywhere, whether stone-paved or dirt, were gray with wind-blown ash trampled into the snow, and the whole city stank of charred wood. Water was one thing Malden apparently never ran short of, but like all Aiel, the Shido placed a very high value on it, and they knew nothing of fighting fires. There was little in the Aiel waste that could burn. They might have let the entire city be consumed had they been finished with stealing, and as it was they dithered over the waste of water before forcing Guyshine into bucket lines at Spearpoint and letting the men of Malden bring out their pump wagons. Fael would have thought the Shido would at least have rewarded those men by allowing them to leave with the people who had escaped being chosen for Gaishine. But the men who worked the pumps were young and fit, just the sort the Shido wanted for their Gaishine. The Shido kept some of the rules regarding Gaishine. Women who were pregnant or had children under the age of 10 had been let go, and youths under 16, and the city's blacksmiths, who had been both mystified and grateful, but gratitude never entered into it. Furniture littered the streets, large overturned tables and ornate chests and chairs, and sometimes a crumpled wall hanging or broken dishes. Bits of clothing lay everywhere, coats and breeches and dresses, most sliced to tatters. The Shido had seized anything made of gold or silver, anything that had gems, anything useful or edible, but the furnishings must have been hauled outside in the frenzy of looting, then abandoned, when whoever was carrying them decided that a little gilded edging or fine carving did not make them worth the effort. Aiel did not use chairs in any case except for chiefs, and there was no room on the carts and wagons for any of those heavy tables. A few Shido still wandered through, searching the houses and inns and shops for anything they might have missed, yet most people she saw were Gaishine carrying buckets. Aiel had no interest in cities except as storehouses to be plundered. A pair of maidens passed her, using the butts of their spears to drive a naked, wild-eyed man, his arms bound behind him toward the gates. Doubtless he had thought he could hide in a basement or attic until the Shido were gone. Doubtless the maidens had thought to find a cache of coin or plate. When a huge man in the cut-in sore of the Algaid Asiswai stepped in front of her, she swerved to go around him as smoothly as she could. A Gaishine always made way for any Shido.
"You are very pretty," he said, putting himself in her way.
He was the biggest man she had ever seen, perhaps 7 feet tall and thick in proportion. Not fat, she had never seen a fat Aiel, but very wide. He belched, and she smelled wine fumes. Drunken Aiel she had seen since they found all those casks of wine here in Malden. She felt no fear, though. Gaishine might be punished for any number of infractions, often for transgressions few of the wetlanders understood, but the white robes gave a certain protection, too, and she had another layer besides. "I am Gaishine to the Wise One, Savannah," she said, in as obsequious a tone as she could manage. To her disgust, she had gotten so she could manage it very well. "Savannah would be displeased if I shirked my duties to talk." She tried again to step around him and gasped when he seized her arm in a hand that could have wrapped around it twice with inches to spare.
"Savannah has hundreds of Gaishine. She will not miss one for an hour or two."
The basket fell to the street as he plucked her into the air as easily as picking up a pillow. Before she knew what was happening, he had her tucked beneath his arm, her own arms trapped at her sides. She opened her mouth to scream, and he used his free hand to press her face flat against his chest. The smell of sweaty wool filled her nose. All she could see was gray-brown wool. Where were those two maidens? Maidens of the Spear would not let him do this. Any Aiel who saw would step in. She never expected help from any of the Gaishine. One or two might run for help if she was lucky, but the very first lesson a Gaishine learned was that even a threat of violence got you hung up by the ankles and beaten till you howled. The first lesson wetlanders learned, at least. Aiel already knew. A Gaishine was forbidden to offer violence for any reason. Any reason. Which did not stop her from kicking at the man furiously. She might as well have been kicking a wall for all the impression it made. He was moving, carrying her somewhere. She bit down as hard as she could and got a mouthful of coarse, dirty wool for her pains, her teeth sliding over muscle with no slack to give her purchase. He seemed made of stone. She screamed, but her shriek sounded muffled even to her own ears. Abruptly, the monster carrying her stopped.
"I made this one Gaishine, Nadric," another man's deep voice said.
Fael felt a rumble of laughter in the chest against her face even before she heard it. She did not stop her kicking,
never stopped writhing or trying to shout, yet her captor seemed unaware of her efforts.
"She belongs to Savannah now, brotherless," the huge man, Nadric, said contemptuously. "Savannah takes what she wants, and I take what I want. It is the new way."
"Savannah took her," the other man replied calmly. "But I never gave her to Savannah. I never offered to trade her to Savannah. Do you abandon your honor because Savannah abandons hers?"
There was a long silence, broken only by the smothered noises Fael was making. She did not stop struggling, could not stop, but she might as well have been an infant in swaddling.
"She is not pretty enough to fight over," Nadric said finally.
He did not sound frightened or even concerned. His hands fell away from her, and Fael's teeth ripped loose from his coat so suddenly she thought one or two might be jerked out, but the ground smashed into her back and all of the air rushed out of her lungs along with most of the wits from her head. By the time she could gather enough breath to push up on her hands, the huge man was striding away down the alley, almost back to the street. It was an alley, a narrow track of dirt between two stone buildings. No one would have seen what he did back here. Shivering, she was not trembling, just shivering, spitting out the taste of unwashed wool and Nadric's sweat, she glared at his back. If the knife she had hidden away had been within reach, she would have stabbed him. Not pretty enough to fight over, was she? Part of her knew that was ludicrous, but she was grabbing hold of anything that could feed her anger just for the warmth of it, to help her stop shivering. She would have stabbed him and stabbed him until she could not lift her arms. Getting up on legs that wobbled, she explored her teeth with her tongue. They were all sound, nothing broken or missing. Her face had been scraped by the rough wool of Nadric's coat, and her lips were bruised, but she was unhurt. She reminded herself of that. She was unhurt and free to walk out of the alley. As free as anyone in Gaishine robes could be, anyway. If there were many like Nadric who no longer saw the protection of those robes, then order was breaking down among the Shido. The camp would be a more dangerous place, but disorder would bring more opportunities for escape. That was how she had to look at this. She had learned something that could aid her. If only she could stop shivering. At last, reluctantly, she looked at her rescuer. She had recognized his voice. He stood well back from her, watching her calmly, making no move to offer sympathy. She thought she would have screamed if he touched her. Another absurdity, since he had rescued her, but a fact all the same. Roland was no more than a hand shorter than Nadric, and almost as wide, and she had reason to want to stab him, too. He was not Shido, but one of the Brotherless, the Meridin, men who had left their clans because they would not follow Randall Thor, and he had indeed been the one to make her Gaishine. True, he had kept her from freezing to death the night after she was captured by wrapping her in his own coat, yet she would not have needed the covering if he had not cut off every last stitch of her clothing in the first place. The first part of being made Gaishine was always being stripped, but that was no reason to forgive him for any of it. "Thank you," she said, the words sour on her tongue.
"I do not ask for gratitude," he said mildly. "Do not look at me as though you want to bite me just because you could not bite Nadric."
She managed not to snarl at him, barely. She could not have summoned meekness right then had she wanted to, before she turned away and stalked back out to the street. Well, she tried to stalk. Her legs were still shaking enough that it was more of a lurch. The passing Gaishine barely glanced in her direction as they trudged along the street with their water buckets. Few of the captives wanted to share anyone else's troubles. They had enough of their own. Reaching the laundry basket, she gave a sigh. It lay on its side. White silk blouses and dark silk skirts divided for riding spilled out over the dirty, ash-smeared pavement. At least it seemed no one had trodden on them. Anyone who had been carrying water all morning and had a day of it to look forward to could have been forgiven if they failed to step aside
with bits of clothing lying all around that had been cut off the people of Malden who had been made Gaishine. She would have tried to forgive them. Righting the basket, she began gathering the clothes, shaking off the dirt and ash that would come loose, and careful not to grind in the rest. Unlike Samarin, Savannah had taken to silk. She wore nothing else. She was as proud of her silks as she was of her jewelry, and equally possessive of both. She would not be pleased if any of these garments failed to be returned clean. As Fael laid the last blouse atop the rest, Roland reached past her and lifted the basket with one hand. On the brink of snapping at him, she could carry her own burdens. Thank you very much, she swallowed the words. Her brain was the only real weapon she possessed, and she had to use it instead of letting her temper have control. Roland had not been here by chance. That was straining credulity too far. She had seen him frequently since she was captured, much more often than chance could account for. He had been following her. What was it he had told Nadric? He had not given her to Savannah, or offered to trade her. For all that he had been the one to capture her, she thought he disapproved of making wetlanders Gaishine. Most of the Brotherless did, but apparently he still claimed his rights to her. She was sure she did not need to fear him trying to force her. Roland had had his chance for that when he had her naked and bound, and he could have been looking at a fence post then. Perhaps he did not like women in that way. In any case, the Brotherless were almost as much outsiders among the Shido as the Wetlanders. None of the Shido really trusted them, and the Brotherless themselves often seemed like men holding their noses, accepting what they considered a lesser wrong rather than embrace a greater, but no longer truly sure that it was lesser. If she could make a friend of the man, perhaps he would be willing to help her. Not to escape, certainly, that would be asking too much, but... or would it? The only way to find out was to try. Thank you, she said again, and this time she worked up a smile. Surprisingly, he smiled back. A small smile, barely there at all, but Aiel were not demonstrative. They could seem stone-faced till you became used to them. For a few paces they walked along side by side in silence, he carrying the basket in one hand and she holding up the skirts of her robes. They might have been out for a stroll, if you squinted. Some of the passing Gaishine looked at them in surprise, but they always put their eyes down again quickly. She could not think of how to begin. She did not want him to think she was flirting. He might like women after all, but he took away the necessity.
I have watched you, he said. You are strong and fierce, and not afraid, I think. Most of the Wetlanders are frightened half out of their heads. They bluster until they are punished, and then they weep and cower. I think you are a woman of much ji.
I am frightened, she replied. I just try not to let it show. Crying never does any good.
Most men believed that.
Tears could get in your way if you let them, but a few tears shed at night could help you make it through the next day.
There are times to weep and times to laugh. I would like to see you laugh.
She did laugh, a dry laugh. There's little reason why I wear white, Roland. She glanced at him out of the corner of her eye. Was she going too fast? But he only nodded.
Still, I would like to see it. Smiles suit your face. Laughter would suit it even better. I have no wife, but I can make a woman laugh sometimes. I have heard you have a husband.
Startled, Fael tripped over her own feet and caught herself on his arm. Quickly she snatched her hand away, studying him past the edge of her cowl. He paused long enough for her to steady herself, then walked on when she did. His expression was no more than mildly curious. Despite Nadric, Aiel custom was for a woman to do the asking, after a man attracted her interest. Giving her gifts was one way. Making her laugh was another. So much for his not liking women. I do have a husband, Roland, and I love him very much. Very much. I can't wait to return to him.
What happens while you are Gaishine cannot be held against you when you put off white, he
he said calmly. But perhaps you wetlanders do not see it that way. Still, it can be lonely when you are Gaishine. Perhaps we can talk sometimes.
The man wanted to see her laugh, and she did not know whether to laugh or cry. He was announcing that he did not intend to give up trying to attract her interest. Aiel women admired perseverance in a man. Still, if Chiad and Bane would not, could not, help beyond giving her aid in reaching the trees, Roland was her best hope. She thought she could convince him, given time. Of course she could. Faint hearts never succeeded. He was a scorned outcast, accepted only because the Shido needed his spear. But she was going to have to give him a reason to persist. "I would like that," she said carefully. A little flirting might be necessary after all, but she could not go from telling him how much she loved her husband straight to wide-eyed and breathless. Not that she had any intention of going that far, she was no Damani, yet she might need to come close. For the time being, a little reminder that Savannah had usurped his right would not go amiss. "I have work to do now, though, and I doubt Savannah would be pleased if I spent the time talking to you instead." Roland nodded again, and Fael sighed. He might know how to make a woman laugh, as he claimed, but he certainly did not talk very much. She was going to have to work to draw him out if she intended to get anything more than jokes she did not understand. Even with Chiad and Bane's help, Aiel humor remained incomprehensible to her. They had reached the broad square in front of the fortress at the north end of the city, a towered mass of gray stone walls that had protected its inhabitants no better than the city walls. Fael thought she had seen the lady who had ruled Malden and everything for 20 miles around, a handsome, dignified widow in her middle years, among the Gaishine hauling water. White-clad men and women carrying buckets crowded the stone-paved square. At the eastern end of the square, what looked like a section of the city's outer wall, gray and 30 feet high, was actually the wall of a huge cistern fed by an aqueduct. 4 pumps, each worked by a pair of men, gushed out water to fill the buckets, a good bit more splashing to the paving stones than the men would have dared allow if they had known Roland was close enough to see. Fael had considered crawling through the tunnel-like aqueduct to escape, but they had no way to keep anything dry, and wherever it let them out, they would be soaking wet and more likely to freeze to death than make it more than a mile or two in the snow. There were 2 other places in the city to get water, both fed by stone conduits underground, but here a long, lion-footed blackwood table had been placed at the foot of the cistern wall. Once it had been a banqueting table, the top inlaid with ivory, but the ivory wedges had been pried out, and several wooden washtubs sat on the tabletop now. A pair of wooden buckets stood beside the table, and at one end a copper kettle steamed over a fire made from broken-up chairs. Fael doubted that Savannah had her laundry carried into the city to save her Gaishine the labor of hauling water out to the tents, but whatever the reason, Fael was grateful. A basket of laundry was lighter than full water buckets. She had carried enough of them to know. 2 baskets stood on the table, but only 1 woman wearing the golden belt and collar was at work, the sleeves of her white robe rolled up as high as they would go, and her long, dark hair tied with a strip of white cloth to keep it from falling into the washtub's water. When Aleandra saw Fael approaching with Roland, she straightened, drying her bare arms on her robe. Aleandra Maritha Kigarin, Queen of Gildan, Blessed of the Light, Defender of Garen's Wall, and 12 more titles, had been an elegant, reserved woman, poised and stately. Aleandra the Gaishine was still pretty, but she wore a perpetually harried expression. With damp patches on her robes and her hands wrinkled from long immersion in the water, she could have passed for a pretty washerwoman. Watching Roland set down the basket and smile at Fael before striding away, watching Fael return the smile, she raised a quizzical eyebrow. "He's the one who captured me," Fael said, setting pieces of clothing from the basket on the table. Even here among none but Guy Shine, it was best to talk while working. He's one of the Brotherless, and I think he doesn't really approve of making wetlanders Guy Shine. I think he may help us.
I see, Alejandra said. With one hand she brushed delicately at the back of Fael's robe.
Frowning, Fael twisted to look over her shoulder. For a moment she stared at the dirt and ash that covered her back from the shoulders down, then heat flooded her face.
I fell, she said quickly.
She could not tell Alejandra what had happened with Nadric. She did not think she could tell anyone.
Roland offered to carry my basket.
Alejandra shrugged.
If he helped me escape, I would marry him. Or not, as he wanted. He's not quite pretty, but it wouldn't be painful. And my husband, if I had one, would never have to know. If he had any sense, he would be overjoyed to have me back and ask no questions he didn't want to hear answers to.
Hands tightening on a silk blouse, Fael gritted her teeth. Alejandra was her liegewoman, through Perrin, and she held to that well enough, at least insofar as obeying commands, but the nature of the relationship had become strained. They had agreed that they must try to think like servants, try to be servants, if they were to survive, yet that meant that each had seen the other curtsying and scurrying to obey. Savannah's punishments were dealt out by the nearest Guy Shine to hand when she made her decision, and once Fael had been ordered to switch Alejandra. Worse, Alejandra had been ordered to return the favor twice. Holding back only meant a taste of the same for yourself, plus the other woman having to endure a double dose from someone who would not spare her arm. It had to make a difference when you had twice made your liege lady kick and shriek. Abruptly she realized that the blouse she was gripping was one of those that had picked up extra dirt when the basket fell. Loosening her grip, she examined the garment anxiously. It did not seem that she had ground the dirt in. For a moment she felt relief, and then irritation at being relieved. Even more irritating, the relief did not go away.
Araland Lacille escaped 3 days ago, she said in a low voice. They should be well away by now. Where is Magdin?
A worried frown appeared on the other woman's face.
She is trying to sneak into Therava's tent.
Therava passed us with a group of wise ones, and from what we overheard they seemed to be on their way to meet with Savannah. Magdin shoved her basket at me and said she was going to try.
I think she's becoming desperate enough to take too many chances,
she said with a touch of hopelessness in her own voice.
She should have been here by now.
Fael drew a deep breath and let it out slowly. They were all becoming desperate. They had gathered supplies for their escape. Knives and food, boots and men's breeches and coats that fit near enough, all carefully hidden in the wagons. The white robes would serve as blankets and as cloaks to hide them in the snow. But the chance to use all that preparation seemed no closer now than the day they were captured. Only 2 weeks. 22 days, to be exact. That should not have been long enough to change anything, but their pretense of being servants was changing them in spite of all they could do. Only 2 weeks, and they found themselves jumping to obey commands without thought, worrying over punishments and whether they were pleasing Savannah. The worst of it was they could see themselves doing these things, knew some part of them was being molded against their wills. For now they could tell themselves they were just doing what was needed to avoid suspicion until they could escape, yet every day the reactions became more automatic. How long before escape was a pale dream dreamed in the night after a day of being a perfect Guy Shine in thought as well as deed? No one had dared ask that question aloud so far, and Fael knew that she herself tried not to think it, but the question was always on the edge of her consciousness. In a way, she was afraid of it leaving. When it did, would it already have been answered? With an effort, she forced herself back from despondency. That was the second trap, and only willpower held it open.
Magdin knows she has to be careful, she said in a firm voice. She will be here soon, Alejandra.
And if she is caught? She won't be. Fail said sharply.
If she was.
No, she had to think of victory, not defeat. Faint hearts never won. Washing the silk was time-consuming. The buckets of water they fetched from the cistern pumps were icy cold, but hot water scooped from the copper kettle brought the temperature in the wash tubs up to lukewarm. You could not wash silk in hot water. Sinking your hands into the wash tubs felt wonderful in the cold, but you always had to take them out again, and then the cold was twice as bitter. There was no soap, not that was mild enough anyway, so each skirt and blouse had to be submersed one by one and delicately scrubbed against itself. Then it was laid on a piece of toweling and gently rolled up to squeeze out as much water as possible. The damp garment was dipped again in another wash tub that was filled with a mixture of vinegar and water that reduced fading and enhanced the gloss of the silk, then rolled up in toweling again. The wet toweling was wrung out hard and spread in the sun to dry wherever there was room, while each piece of silk was hung on a horizontal pole, slung in the shade of a rough canvas pavilion erected at the edge of the square and smoothed by hand to rub out wrinkles. With luck, nothing would need ironing. Both of them knew how silk had to be cared for, but ironing it needed experience neither of them had. None of Savannah's Guy Shine did. Not even Magden, though she had been a lady's maid even before entering Fael's service, but Savannah did not accept excuses. Every time Fael or Alejandra went to hang another garment, they checked those already there and smoothed any that seemed to need it. Fael was adding hot water to a wash tub when Alejandra said bitterly, "Here comes the Aes Sedai." Galena was Aes Sedai, complete with the ageless face and a golden great serpent ring on her finger, but she wore white guyshine robes too, in silk as thick as anyone else's wool, no less, along with a wide, elaborate belt of gold and firedrops that cinched her waist tightly, and a tall matching collar around her neck, jewels fit for a monarch. She was Aes Sedai, and sometimes rode out from the camp alone, but she always returned, and she jumped when any wise one crooked a finger, especially Thorava, whose tent she often shared. In a way, that last was the strangest thing of all. Galena knew who Fael was, knew who her husband was and Perrin's connection to Rand Al'Thor, and she threatened to reveal it to Savannah unless Fael and her friends stole something from the very tent she slept in. That was the third trap lying in wait for them. Savannah was obsessed with Al'Thor, insanely convinced that she could somehow marry him, and if she learned about Perrin, Fael would never be allowed far enough out of her sight to think of escape. She would be staked out like a goat to draw a lion. Fael had seen Galena slinking and cowering, but now the sister glided through the square like a queen disdaining the rabble around her, an Aes Sedai to the hilt. There were no wise ones here for her to simper at. Galena was pretty, but nowhere near beautiful, and Fael did not understand what Thorava saw in her, unless it was simply the pleasure of dominating an Aes Sedai. That still left the question of why the woman remained, when Thorava seemed to take every opportunity to humiliate her. Stopping a pace from the table, Galena surveyed them with a small smile that might have been called pitying. "You are not progressing very far in your work," she said. She was not speaking of the laundry. It was Fael's place to do the talking, but Alejandra spoke up, even more bitterly than before. "Magden went to fetch your ivory rod this morning, Galena. When will we see some of the help you promised?" Help in their escape was the carrot Galena offered, along with the stick of threatening Fael's exposure. So far, however, they had seen only the stick. "She went to Thorava's tent this morning?" Galena whispered, the blood draining from her face. It dawned on Fael that the sun was halfway down to the horizon in the west, and her heart began to thud painfully. Magden should have joined them long since. The Aes Sedai seemed even more shaken than she. "This morning?" Galena repeated, looking over her shoulder. She gave a start and a cry when Magdan suddenly appeared out of the throng of Gaishine crowding the square. Unlike Aleandra, the golden-haired woman had grown tougher by the day since their capture. She was no less desperate, but she seemed to focus it all into determination. She always had a presence that belonged more to a queen than a lady's maid, though most ladies' maids had it. But now she stumbled past them, dull-eyed, and plunged her hands into a water bucket, cupping a double handful to her mouth to drink thirstily, then scrubbing the back of a hand across her mouth.
"I want to kill Thurava when we go," she said thickly. "I would like to kill her now."
Her blue eyes took on life again and heat.
"You're safe, Galena. She thought I was there to steal. I hadn't started looking. Something happened, and she left. After tying me up. For later."
The heat faded from her gaze to be replaced by puzzlement.
"What is it, Galena? Even I feel it, and I have so little ability these Aiel women decided I was no danger."
Magdan could channel. Not reliably, though, and not very much. From what little Fael knew, the White Tower would have sent her away in a matter of weeks, and she claimed never to have gone, so her ability would not be of much use in aiding their escape. Fael would have asked what she was talking about, but she never got the chance. Galena's face was still pale, but otherwise she was all Aes Sedai calm, except that she seized a handful of Magdan's cowl and the hair beneath, and wrenched her head back.
"Never you mind what it is," she said coolly. "Nothing to do with you. All you need worry about is getting me what I want. But you should worry about that very hard."
Before Fael could move to defend Magdan, another woman wearing the wide golden belt over her white robes was there, pulling Galena away and slinging her to the ground. Plump and plain, Aravine had been weary-eyed and resigned the first time Fael saw her, the day the Amadisian woman handed her the golden belt she wore and told her she was now in the service of the Lady Savannah. The intervening days had stiffened Aravine even more than they had Magdan, though.
"Are you mad to lay hands on an Aes Sedai?" Galena snapped, struggling to her feet.
Brushing at the dirt staining her silk robes, she directed all her fury at the plump woman.
"I will have you—" "Shall I tell Thurava you were manhandling one of Savannah's Gaishine?" Aravine broke in coldly.
Her accents were cultured. She might have been a merchant of some note, or perhaps even a noble, but she never spoke of what she had been before putting on white.
"The last time Thurava thought you'd poked your nose where she didn't want it, everybody inside 100 paces could hear you squealing and begging."
Galena actually quivered with rage, the first time Fael had ever seen an Aes Sedai so outdone. With a visible effort, she gained control of herself.
"Just." Her voice dripped acid. "Aes Sedai do what we do for our own reasons, Aravine, reasons you could not possibly understand. You will regret incurring this debt when I decide to collect payment. You will regret it to your heart."
Giving her robes a last brush, she stalked away, no longer the queen disdaining rabble, but a leopard daring sheep to block her path. Watching her go, Aravine seemed unimpressed and uninclined to chat.
"Savannah wants you, Fael," was all she said.
Fael did not bother to ask why. She just dried her hands, rolled down her sleeves, and followed the Amadisian woman, after promising Aleandra and Magdan to return as soon as she could. Savannah was fascinated with the three of them. Magdan, the only true lady's maid among her Gaishine, seemed to interest her as much as Queen Aleandra, and Fael herself, a woman powerful enough to have a queen as her liege woman, and sometimes she summoned one of them by name to help her change clothes or bathe in the large copper bathtub that she used more often than the sweat tent, or just to pour her wine. The rest of the time they were given the same chores as her other servants, but she never asked whether they had already been assigned work or let them off because of it. Whatever Savannah wanted, Fail knew she still would be held accountable for the laundry along with the other two. Savannah wanted what she wanted when she wanted it, and she did not accept excuses. There was no need for Fail to be shown the way to Savannah's tent, but Aravine led the way through the throng of water carriers until they reached the first low Aiel tents, and then she pointed in the opposite direction to Savannah's tent and said, "This way, first." Fail stopped where she stood. "Why?" she asked suspiciously. There were actually men and women among Savannah's servants who were jealous of the attentions she gave Fail, Aleandra, and Magden. And though Fail had never detected that in Aravine, some of the rest might well try to get them in trouble by passing on false instructions. "You will want to see this before you see Savannah. Believe me." Fail opened her mouth to demand more explanation, but Aravine simply turned and walked away. Fail gathered up the skirts of her robes and followed. All sorts and sizes of carts and wagons stood among the tents, their wheels replaced by sleds. Most were piled high with bundles and wooden crates and barrels, with the wheels tied on top of the loads. But she did not have to follow Aravine far before she saw a flatbed cart that had been emptied. Except that the cart bed was not empty. Two women lay on the rough wooden planks, naked and cruelly hog-tied, shivering in the cold, yet panting as if they were running. Both women's heads hung tiredly, but as if they somehow knew Fail was there, both looked up. Arila, a dark tyrant as tall as most Aiel women, averted her eyes in embarrassment. Lassiel, slim and pale, and Kyrianen went bright red. "They were brought back this morning," Aravine said, watching Fail's face. "They will be untied before dark, since it's the first time they've tried to escape, though I doubt they will be in any condition to walk before tomorrow." "Why did you show me this?" Fail said. They had been so careful to keep the connection between them a secret. "You forget, my lady. I was there when you were all put in white." Aravine studied her a moment, then suddenly took Fail's hands and turned them so that her own hands were between Fail's palms. Bending her knees just short of kneeling, she said quickly, "Under the light and by my hope of rebirth, I, Aravine Carnell, do pledge my fealty and obedience in all things to the Lady Fail Tebara." Only Lassiel appeared to have noticed. The Shido walking past paid no mind to two Gaishine women. Fail jerked her hands free. "How do you know that name?" She had had to give more of her name than Fail, of course, but she had chosen Fail Bashir once she realized that none of the Shido had a clue who Davram Bashir was. Aside from Aleandra and the others, only Galina knew the truth, or so she had thought. "And who have you told?"
"I listen, my lady. I overheard Galina speaking to you once."
Anxiety touched Aravine's voice.
"And I have told no one."
She did not sound surprised that Fail wanted to hide her name, though clearly Tebara meant nothing to her. Perhaps Aravine Carnell was not her true name, or not all of it.
"In this place secrets must be held as closely as in Amador. I knew these women were yours, but I told no one. I know you intend to escape. I've been certain since the second or third day, and nothing I've seen since convinces me otherwise. Accept my oath and take me with you. I can help, and what is more, I can be trusted. I have proved it by keeping your secrets. Please."
The last word came out strained, as if from someone unused to saying it. A noblewoman, then, rather than a merchant. The woman had proven nothing beyond that she could spy out secrets, but that in itself was a useful trait. On the other hand, Fail knew of at least two Gaishine who had tried to escape and been betrayed by others. Some people really did try to feather their own nests, no matter what the circumstances. But Aravine already knew enough to ruin everything. Fail thought about her hidden knife again. A dead woman could betray nothing.
But the knife was half a mile away. She could think of no way to hide the body, and besides, the woman could have curried favor with Savannah just by saying she thought Fail was planning escape. Taking Aravine's hands between hers, she spoke as quickly as the other woman had. "Under the light, I do accept your pledge and will defend and protect you and yours through battle's rack and winter's blast and all that time may bring. Now, do you know anyone else who can be trusted? Not people you think you can trust, people you know you can?" "Not with this, my lady," Aravine said grimly. Her face shone with relief, though. She had not been sure Fail would accept her. That it was relief rather than anything else made Fail tend to believe in her. Tend to, which was not to say completely. Half would betray their own mothers in hopes of buying freedom, and the other half are too afraid to try or too stunned to be trusted not to panic. There must be some, and I have my eye on one or two, but I want to be very careful. One mistake is one more than I'll be allowed.
Very careful, Fail agreed.
Did Savannah really send for me? If she didn't, it seemed that she had. And Fail was quick about reaching Savannah's tent, quicker than she would have liked, in truth. It was irritating to leap to avoid Savannah's displeasure, but no one paid her the slightest heed when she walked in and stood meekly by the entry flaps. Savannah's tent was no low Aiel structure, but a wall tent of red canvas large enough to need two center poles, lit by near a dozen mirrored stand lamps. Two gilded braziers gave a little warmth, emitting thin tendrils of smoke that eddied out through the smoke holes in the roof, but the interior was little warmer than outside. Rich carpets, the snow carefully scraped away before they were laid, made a floor of reds and greens and blues, Tyran mazes and flowers and animals. Tasseled silk cushions lay strewn about the carpets, and one chair, a massive thing intricately carved and heavily gilded, sat in a corner. Fail had never seen anyone sit in it, but its presence was supposed to evoke the presence of a clan chief, she knew. She was just as happy to stand quietly with her eyes down. Three other Gaishine with golden belts and collars, one a bearded male, stood along one wall of the tent in case some service was needed. Savannah was there, and so was Therava. Savannah was a tall woman, a little taller than Fail herself, with pale green eyes and hair like spun gold. She might have been beautiful except for a strong hint of avarice around her plump mouth. Little about her really seemed Aiel, beyond her eyes and hair and sun-dark face. Her blouse was white silk, her skirt divided for riding and also silk, if a dark gray, and the scarf folded around her temples was a blaze of crimson and gold, also silk. Red boots peeked out beneath the hem of her skirt when she moved. Jeweled rings decorated her every finger, and her necklaces and bracelets of fat pearls and cut diamonds and rubies as large as pigeons' eggs, sapphires and emeralds and firedrops, paled anything Somerin had. Not a single one was Aiel made. Therava, on the other hand, was all Aiel, in dark wool and white algoda, her hands bare and her necklaces and bracelets gold and ivory. No finger rings or gems for her. Taller than most men, her dark red hair touched with streaks of white, she was a blue-eyed eagle that it seemed must devour Savannah like a crippled lamb. Fail would rather anger Savannah 10 times than Therava once, but the two women faced each other across a table inlaid with ivory and turquoise, and Savannah met Therava glare for glare. "What is happening today means danger," Therava said with the air of someone tired of repeating herself, and perhaps about to draw the knife at her belt. She caressed the hilt as she spoke, and not entirely absently, Fail thought. "We need to put as much distance between ourselves and whatever it is as we possibly can, and as soon as we can. There are mountains to the east. Once we reach them, we can be safe until we gather all the septs together again. Septs that would never have been separated if you had not been so sure of yourself, Savannah."
"You speak of safety," Savannah laughed. "Have you grown so old and toothless you need to be fed milk and bread?
Look, these mountains of yours are how distant? How many days or weeks when we must crawl through this cursed snow? She gestured to the table between them where a map lay spread out, weighted down with two thick golden bowls and a heavy three-pronged golden candlestick. Most Aiel disdained maps, but Savannah had taken to them along with other wetland customs. Whatever happened is far away, Therava. You agreed it is so, as did every wise one. This city is full of food, enough to feed us for weeks if we remain here. Who is there to challenge us if we do? And if we do? You have heard the runners, the messages. In 2 or 3 weeks, 4 at the most, 10 more septs will have joined me, perhaps more. This snow will have melted by then if these wetlanders from the city can be believed. We will travel quickly instead of having to drag everything on sleds. Fael wondered whether any of the city people had mentioned mud. 10 more septs will join you, Therava said, her voice flat except for the last word. Her hand tightened on the knife hilt. You speak for the clan chief, Savannah, and so I was chosen to advise you as clan chief, who must listen to advice for the good of our clan. I advise you to move east and keep moving east. The other septs can join us as easily in those mountains as here, and if we must go a little hungry on the way, who among us is a stranger to privation? Savannah fingered her necklaces, a large emerald on her right hand like green fire in the light of the stand lamps. Her mouth tightened and seemed hungrier for it. She might have known privation, but despite the lack of warmth in the tent, she no longer chose to. I speak for the chief, and I say we will remain here. There was more than a hint of challenge in her voice, but she did not give Therava a chance to meet it. Ah, I see that Fael has come, my good, obedient Gaishine. Taking something wrapped in a cloth from the table, she stripped away the cloth. Do you recognize this, Fael Bashir? What Savannah held was a knife with a single-edged blade, a hand and a half long, a simple tool of the sort that thousands of farmers carried, except that Fael recognized the pattern of rivets in the wooden handle and the chip in the edge. It was the knife that she had stolen and hidden away with such care. She said nothing. There was nothing to say. Gaishine were forbidden to possess any weapon, even a knife, except when cutting meat or vegetables for cooking. She could not help jerking when Savannah went on, though. As well Galena brought me this before you could use it, for whatever purpose. If you stabbed someone, I would have to be very angry with you. Galena? Of course. The Aes Sedai would not allow them to escape before they did as she wanted. She is shocked, Therava. Savannah's laughter was amused. Galena knows what is required of Gaishine, Fael Bashir. What should I do with her, Therava? That is advice you can give me. Several wetlanders have been killed for hiding weapons, but I would hate to lose her. Therava tipped Fael's chin up with a finger and stared into her eyes. Fael met that gaze without blinking, but she felt her knees tremble. She did not try telling herself it was only the cold. Fael knew she was not a coward, but when Therava looked at her, Fael saw herself as a rabbit in that eagle's talons, alive and waiting for the beak to descend. It had been Therava who first told her to spy on Savannah, and however circumspect the other wise ones might have been, Fael had no doubt that Therava would slit her throat without the slightest qualm if she failed her. There was no use pretending the woman did not frighten her. She just had to control that fear. If she could. I think she was planning to run away, Savannah. But I think she can learn to do as she is told. The rough wooden table had been set out between the tents in the nearest open space to Savannah's tent, 100 paces away. At first, Fael thought that the shame of being naked would be the worst of it. That and the icy cold that pebbled her skin. The sun sat low in the sky. The air had grown colder, and it would get much colder before morning. She had to stay there till morning. The Shido were good at learning what shamed wetlanders, and they used shame as a punishment. She thought she would die of blushing whenever anyone looked at her, but the Shido who passed by did not even pause. In itself, nudity was no reason for shame among Aiel. Aravine appeared in front of her, but she stopped only long enough to whisper, "Keep your courage," and then she was gone. Fael understood. Whether or not the woman was loyal, she did not dare do anything to help. After a very short time, Fael no longer worried about shame. Her wrists had been tied behind her, and then her ankles had been doubled back and tied to her elbows. She understood now why Lasile and Arala had been panting. Breathing was an effort in this position. The cold bit deeper and deeper until she was shivering uncontrollably, but even that soon seemed secondary. Cramps began to burn in her legs, her shoulders, her sides, bunching muscles that seemed on fire, twisting tighter and tighter and tighter. She focused on not screaming. That became the center of her existence. She would not scream, but, oh, light, she hurt.
"Savannah ordered that you were to remain here till dawn, Fael Bashir, but she did not say you could not have company."
She had to blink several times before she could see clearly. Sweat stung her eyes. How could she be sweating when she was frozen to the marrow? Roland was standing in front of her, and strangely he was carrying a pair of low bronze braziers full of glowing coals, with pieces of cloth wrapped around a leg of each to protect his hands from the heat. Seeing her stare at the braziers, he shrugged.
"Once a night in the cold would not have bothered me, but I've grown soft since I crossed the dragon wall."
She almost gasped when he set the braziers beneath the table. Warmth flooded up through the cracks beneath the planks. Her muscles still shrieked with cramps, but oh, the blessed warmth! She did gasp when the man put an arm across her chest and the other across her bent elbows. Suddenly, she realized the pressure was gone from her elbows. He had squeezed her. One of his hands began working at her thigh, and she almost screamed as his fingers dug into knotted muscles, but she felt the knots begin to loosen. They still hurt, his massaging hurt, but the pain in that one thigh muscle was changing in kind. Not growing less exactly, but she knew that it would if he continued.
"You do not mind if I occupy myself while I try to think of a way to make you laugh, do you?" he asked.
Suddenly she realized that she was laughing, and not hysterically. Well, it was only partly hysteria. She was trussed like a goose for the oven, and being saved from the cold for a second time by a man she thought maybe she would not stab after all. Savannah would be watching her like a hawk from now on, and Tharava might be trying to kill her as an example. But she knew she was going to escape. One door never closed, but another opened. She was going to escape. She laughed until she cried.